It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Open to Debate. I'm John Donvan, and I want to ask you to ponder this. Where would you rather live if you had to choose one of these, New York or Florida? You know, a full decade ago, we did a debate where the motion was for a better future, live in a red state. And what were the issues argued over then? Well, it was taxes and services and safety net and lifestyle and culture and values. It was a pretty good argument. I recommend listening to it. But we figured here at Open to Debate, 10 years on, a lot has changed and it's time for an update. But let's get more specific about it this time. So given that Florida, once considered a swing state, but definitely gone more and more red, and New York, and when you think of a blue state, you think of New York and you think of its policies, which definitely remain blue, we have chosen to make those our two example states. So here's the question we're asking. Is Florida eating New York's lunch? Arguing that the answer is a definite yes, that Florida is eating New York's lunch, conservative political commentator and president of the Manhattan Institute, Raihan Salam. Raihan, thanks so much for joining us at Open to Debate.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And our second debater who will be answering no, that Florida is not eating New York's lunch, the former mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio. Bill de Blasio, thanks so much for joining us on Open to Debate.
Great to be here, John. Thanks for this chance.
So what I find so interesting is that we have two New York-born debaters. Bill, you were born in Manhattan, like I was, and Raihan, you were born in Brooklyn, like my dad was, but we're going to be arguing about a competition for between two states for general appeal and governance effectiveness. So I want to get straight to it and ask each of you to take a few minutes to tell us in a more formal way why you're arguing yes or why you are arguing no. And Raihan, you are up first. Once again, your answer to the question, yes, Florida is eating New York's lunch. Tell us why.
Let me begin by saying that I was born and raised in New York. It is my home, and I love it dearly. But despite New York's immense advantages, Florida is eating our lunch. I want to be very clear. I am not claiming that the Sunshine State is the best option for every family, or that Ron DeSantis is always right and Kathy Hochul is always wrong. Like all sane people, I would much prefer a slice of cheesecake to a slice of key lime pie. What I am saying is that Florida is badly outcompeting New York. For a decade, New York's leaders have been asleep at the switch. Even now, there's this delusion that Wall Street, big tech, and cultural cachet mean that Gotham doesn't have to fight for talent like lesser places. But those days are over for three main reasons. First, New York's superpower was once its ability to create opportunity for its working class while welcoming newcomers. But today, New York is driving away striving families while Florida is rolling out the red carpet. Consider the huge gap in housing prices. The median home price in Manhattan is twice the median price for a larger, more modern home in Miami. Places like Orlando and Tampa are much more affordable. So why the difference? New York zoning laws make it obscenely expensive to build new housing. Florida makes it much easier for developers to meet rising demand from newcomers fleeing New York and other less affordable states. And like it or not, affordability matters. Second, New York City's greatest asset, its incredible density, is in danger of becoming a liability. The reason the streets of New York are so vibrant is that the city is tightly packed with creative people. That means you have enough customers to support off-Broadway theater, comedy clubs, and ethnic cuisine from all over. But if you're going to pack people together, you need to keep a handle on noise, congestion, and crime. Florida's big cities are actually not safer than New York's. The difference is that in Florida, people typically live in less dense neighborhoods. In other words, New Yorkers depend on a competent government to stop the guy yelling at my toddlers on the B69 bus. Floridians can just hop in their SUVs. I personally prefer the New York way of life, but when public safety starts to slip in dense cities like ours, people start rushing for the exits. Third, we all know New Yorkers pay much more in taxes than Floridians, but the bigger problem for New York is that higher taxes aren't buying better results. Take public education. Pre-COVID, New York was spending roughly 26 $1,000 per K-12 student. In Florida, spending was $10,000, or less than half as much. So did New York's first-in-the-nation spending buy first-in-the-nation results? Not by a long shot. In 2019, the Urban Institute ranked reading and math performance in the 50 states, taking into account differences in student characteristics. Florida came in first on reading and math results for fourth graders. New York was 23rd in reading and 39th in math. The reason is that public schools in Florida do a much better job of boosting the achievement of students of color and English language learners. That's part of why tens of thousands of black families have left New York for Florida and Texas over the past decade. They have a right to good schools, and New York is not delivering. I know New York can once again be a beacon of opportunity for all in my bones. And in the age of remote work, we can't afford to be complacent. When skilled professionals and working people can work from anywhere, they are going to work from places that actually work hard to attract them, to keep them. But until New York's leaders reckon with Florida's rise, we won't do what it takes to compete and win.
Thank you, Raihan. So that's the argument for the answering the question yes. And now we're going to hear the argument for answering the question no. Bill de Blasio, the former mayor of New York, to say no, Florida is not eating New York's lunch. Tell us why.
An emphatic no, John. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Let me start with a story, and it's very personal. Over 100 years ago, my grandfather Giovanni and my grandmother Anna left small, poor towns in southern Italy. They came to this place, and the opportunity here, the fact that this was a place that was open to all, afforded them the chance to live the New York dream, the American dream. They had three daughters, all of whom went to college, including my mother Maria, and their grandson became mayor of this great city. This city hasn't changed who we are. We have challenges, undoubtedly. But the essence of New York remains, it's eternal. We're a place that rewards creativity, entrepreneurship, energy. We foster it. We're a city for everyone. We're a city that believes and embraces diversity. We are not scared of people with different opinions. We want to respect every choice and the range of beliefs that people have. And that makes us vibrant, that makes us strong, that makes us a place that creative people want to be. And that's even more true in a globalized world. New York City is the ideal global city. I respect, for sure, our friends and colleagues in Florida. I've visited Florida several times. I've enjoyed my visits. I'm not here to be negative to another state. I'm here to say that all New Yorkers should stand up and proudly say, this place is eternal in our strength. Look at what we went through in our greatest challenge. Arguably, we have had so many, 9-11 and the Great Recession and Hurricane Sandy, but in our greatest challenge recently that affected literally every New Yorker was COVID. We at one point were the epicenter, and it was extremely painful, the epicenter in this whole nation. Did New Yorkers give up? Did they turn against each other? No, as we could see so many times in the past, but I think in many ways this was New York's finest hour. New Yorkers supported each other. They showed incredible compassion, incredible energy and bravery, a kind of resilience that is unmatched in the nation. That speaks to the character of our people. And in the end, what makes New York great is our people, this extraordinary mix of people, arguably the most diverse place on earth, and yet it works in so many ways. Every part of the country has strengths, but no place has this extraordinary population, which includes, in my view, the finest workforce in America, the hardest workers in America. I appreciate my colleague Raihan and his view, but if he wants to know what our tax dollars are buying, it's buying the finest police force in America, the finest fire department in America, a place that provides, even though it's imperfect, the most extensive mass transit of any city by far. And by the way, we don't want people in SUVs and experiencing urban sprawl. We want people in cities that actually are part of how we save this earth from climate change. And we need exactly the things that we have here in New York City. We've got more work to do. I'm the first to say it. But I want to give you one example that's extraordinary. After all of the pain, all the setbacks of COVID, just 3 years ago around this time. Last year, New York City received 57 million tourists. That says something about how much people want to be here. They want to be here to live, they want to be here to create, but they also want to be here to visit. In numbers that are approaching our all-time high, the last year before COVID in my administration, 67 million tourists. It is now projected we will surpass that in the next year or two. The price of housing, yes, the price of housing is high and there's a lot to be done, but it also says something that the property values in the city are so high, that the rents are high because people want to be here. Now, our job is to continually create more housing. I agree. And that's what my administration tried to do. And I know that's what Mayor Adams is doing. But in the end, a place that has the challenge of too many people wanting to be here, that's a great starting point for a great future. I have to tell you, the future is in those places that will embrace everyone. I look at our incredible economy. It's extraordinarily diverse. Our tech sector was growing up through COVID, continues to. Our life sciences sector and all the traditional industries, finance, media, cultural fields. People want to be here because they feel safe from extremism. They feel safe from intolerance. Yes, we always have work to do on our quality of life, and thankfully it is improving and the city is getting safer. We have the NYPD facts to prove it. But one thing that we know is profoundly different between New York and Florida. Florida is going in the wrong direction, unfortunately. When it comes to MAGA extremism, Florida is choosing a path of banning books and disallowing a woman's right to choose. Florida's turning against trans youth. Florida's a place that a lot of smart, creative, entrepreneurial people are going to say, this isn't for me anymore. This doesn't fit what I believe. And in fact, you're going to start to see people leave Florida and return to New York because it's a place they can believe in and feel comfortable in. So I think in the end, New York City is a place of greatness and always has been. I think New York City will be greater even more in the future. I think that one day in this country, I truly believe, will improve our immigration laws, and you're going to see people from all over this world returning in great numbers to live and help us build our community. But we've got plenty of homegrown New Yorkers right now who are doing that work. And if you walk in these streets, if you go to our restaurants, if you look at our businesses, they are thriving. It is visible, the vitality you can feel. And this is, again, 3 years after we were laid as low as any city could possibly be in this country. We're back and strong, and we will be stronger still in the next few years.
This is Open to Debate. More when we return.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Welcome back to Open to Debate. I'm your host, John Donvan. Let's return to our discussion. I do want to go to the quantitative analysis that you brought to this, Raihan, but I want to start with the qualitative. Because I think it's the greatest sort of philosophical challenge to your argument at this point, that in compared to New York, Florida is not so good when it comes to the values of openness, diversity, et cetera, as Bill has been saying. So what's your response to that?
So one thing I'll say is that if you want diversity, if you want a flourishing place, you really do want density. You said that I was concerned about overcrowding, but just to be very, very clear, I actually believe that density is a superpower. But here's what density does. Here's what it means. What density means is that your margin of error is smaller than it otherwise would be. If you look at the densest cities in the rich world, you've got Tokyo, you've got Hong Kong, you've got Singapore, you've got places where the level of congestion and violent crime is just dramatically lower than what it is here. Florida, you know, you can object. I said very explicitly, you don't have to agree with Ron DeSantis on X, Y, or Z. If you're a recent immigrant, if you're a working class person, okay, from the Rust Belt, you're from the Bronx, and if you're looking for a place to build a life, I'm sorry to say that those are problems that matter a heck of a lot to people who have that choice, people who aren't actually on the edge of making ends meet. And actually, New York City is doing a pretty good job of keeping rich people. A lot of people who will have this debate will say, we're driving out rich people, we're driving out rich people, and sure, we're driving out some, but actually we're really losing strivers. We're really losing working and middle class people. What's happening is the gentrification of New York.
So, Raihan, is your framing of it that way in response to my question about extremism, et cetera, is your point being there are other things that value that are of more value to what you describe as striving families?
Yeah, there's an old saying which goes, it's a matter of show or tell, right? And there's a lot of tell in politics, but then the show is actually who is actually making opportunity available and accessible.
Okay, let me take that back then to Bill de Blasio. You heard Raihan's response. The thing that really matters to people who are trying to make it in this world are economic opportunity that he says is just shrinking, housing being like the most prominent cause of that. Potentially taxes as well, are just shrinking for sort of what he calls striving families. And I think we know what he means by that. We mean not the billionaires, but we mean people who are trying to make it, your grandparents from back then now. So what's your response to that as a counter to the argument you were making?
I will respond to that, but I have to also respond with deepest respect for Raihan. You know, John, you very clearly said, let's speak to the question of intolerance and exclusion that pervades Florida. I really didn't hear an answer. I heard him say,
what I heard was
that's
true. I heard him do a pivot. I heard him do a
right. pivot. But obviously, in Florida today, unfortunately, not just via Ron DeSantis, via the legislature of Florida and beyond, that same intolerance is rampant. That is not a welcome mat. And if one makes an argument that because in recent years, Florida had some years where people went there, and God bless them, you know, good weather and other good factors, it does not say things are static. In a world where people of all classes and all backgrounds want to be safe from intolerance and extremism, Florida is rolling up that welcome mat constantly, and they're saying, you don't belong here. And that's a lot of different kinds of people. Talk to women who just received the news that their governor signed a 6-week abortion ban. For millions of women in Florida, they're going to be asking the question whether this is a state for them going forward. So I think there's a lot more here than just cost of living. If you want to talk about pure opportunity, there is no place in the United States of America with so much concentrated opportunity. And that is why people continue to come here, even with overly restrictive immigration laws. Come here from all around the world. Certainly, you see people streaming in from all over the country of all classes, all backgrounds, because whatever your interest is, whatever your field is, the opportunity in New York is unparalleled. And it's also not just about the numerical opportunity. It is the meaning of that opportunity. People who succeed in New York are able to do things on a much bigger scale, and they know it. An incredible statistic from the New York Times just a few weeks back. You know, there's been a lot of concern about some millionaires leaving, going to Florida and other places. Fair concern. But here's what the Times told us. In 2020, there were 70,000 millionaires in New York City, 70,000. 1 year later, there were 80,000. Because we grow wealth here, too. There's so much opportunity, and there's so many of the kinds of people who want to, whether they're a cab driver or someone who creates their own business, people who want to further themselves and their families and can do it here. Costs are higher than they should be. I agree. A lot more we need to do. But opportunity is the greatest in the country.
But when you say costs are higher than there should be, and when you refer to there are challenges that we have, of course, are you not making Raihan's point that it could be great? It could be even better, but it's not.
No. It is supremely great and will be greater. And globalization has created a dynamic where New York City and all of our strengths are magnified many times over. So can you address costs? Sure you can. We did it in part by raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. We did it by giving families free pre-K and 3K. You can do a lot to build more affordable housing. By the way, I believe this is a city that we know how to build a lot of housing and to do it quickly, do it densely. Much of the rest of the country will not accept tall buildings and dense housing.
It's certainly true that globalization is changing things, that technology is changing things. One of the big changes is that remote work has gone through a dramatic step increase. So, you know, for example, if you look at the early 1990s, New York City alone represented about a third of all financial services jobs in the country. Today, we're approaching single digits. That's not necessarily a bad thing. We want a more diversified economy. That's a good thing. What it means is that if you're in financial services, there was a time when the only place you could do it was in Wall Street, right? Now you can do it in West Palm Beach. You can do it in Miami. Same thing with building a tech company. I might not love that. You might not love that, but that's the reality. The gap to some degree is smaller than it had been. I love New York, love being in the biggest, densest city in the country, but that is a reality that we have to reckon with. And we can talk all about how great we are. I love patting myself on the back. I think New York City is great. I pay a lot of money to live here. I'm blessed by the fact that my parents managed to buy a house in the 1980s. Had they not, I might not be here right now. That if you are not lucky, if you're not connected, if you don't luck into a rent-controlled apartment, if you don't know the right guy, if you don't know the right palm to grease, then actually it is very hard for you as an outsider to make it here.
Bill de Blasio, that sounds totally true.
I have to contest that. First of all, the facts are so rarely cited about what makes us different on affordability than any other city in this country. About 2.2 million New Yorkers live in rent-stabilized housing, where their rent never goes up in extreme ways. 2.2 million people. That doesn't get talked about enough. About 400,000 people live in public housing. It needs a lot of work, and we have to do a lot to improve it. But they are protected from gentrification. We developed an affordable housing plan to reach another 700,000 people, making sure no one pays more than 30% of their income in rent. This city is doing more than any place to protect affordability. We got a lot more to do.
Versus what opportunities for housing in Florida?
Again, the problem I have with the minute you talk about what Rehan pointed out before, urban sprawl, SUVs, taking away more and more of nature to build single family homes, that is not sustainable. It's actually dangerous for our planet.
One thing we are doing so far, perhaps to our regret, is we are conflating New York City with New York State. Rehan, talk about your argument at the state level, because you know, you get out of New York City, it's not so blue.
This is a much larger conversation, John, but one thing that's happened is that outside of downstate New York, New York State is hollowing out. Policies that New York City, by virtue of its density and productivity, might be able to sustain have been fatal for Rochester, for Utica, for Syracuse, for any number of other cities in the rest of New York State. Despite the fact that, you know, these are regions that had big advantages, these are regions that are seeing vast out-migration. And then when you look at the suburban ring surrounding New York City, surrounding the five boroughs, the affordability problems are actually even more dire in those places. So if you want to make a state-to-state comparison, one thing that's notable, in Florida, there are five times the number of houses valued at less than $100,000 than above $750,000. Over 63% of the housing stock in Florida is priced below $300,000. And because if you have not been in a rent-stabilized apartment for the last 10, 15, 20 years, and thank goodness for those guys, they're very lucky, God bless them. But if you're someone who's new to the city, as I imagine, you know, kind of a lot of recent college graduates, recent immigrants, other recent striving people will find, you're in a bad spot.
Let's bring it to Bill now.
Florida is unfortunately pursuing a series of policies that are going to cause decline, because what they're saying to so many of their own people, let alone people from other places, is you don't belong here, or your voice doesn't count, or there's something wrong with you. Now, you can't just, you know, unless you happen to take a Marxian analysis here, you can't just talk about economics. You have to talk about cultural and political factors as well. Florida has some strengths, but Florida is rapidly and aggressively undermining those strengths.
I do want to make one point here. It is worth noting that New York City's workforce as of early this year, 2023, shrank by 300,000 since 2020. And actually, when you look at where the job recovery has not happened, it's in construction, it's in retail, It's in leisure and hospitality. And why do I mention those fields? Those are the areas where actually working-class immigrants, blue-collar workers, have gained a foothold in this state. And the fact that we still have this massive gap is something that I think is worth reflecting on. The workforce is quite strong, but it shrunk for a lot of reasons. And one big reason that workforce has shrunk so significantly is that there are a lot of people who've moved to Florida and elsewhere. And I think that it's worth noting. Really strong workforce. And actually, by the way, maybe on a kind of average basis, there's certain kinds of people who might believe that pricing people out, driving the people out who are at the kind of bottom of the income spectrum, so makes the workforce stronger.
Let me bring in a number to you, Bill de Blasio. The Wall Street Journal data published in last month, back to December 2022, unemployment rate in the state of New York, 4.3% versus Florida's 2.5%. Which seems to lend ammunition to the point that Rayhan is making in terms of opportunity to be in the workforce.
So look, first of all, the three sectors that Rayhan mentioned, retail is in crisis all over this country. I think new solutions will be found, but it's been in crisis for years, even pre-pandemic. The pandemic intensified it. Construction obviously was affected deeply by the pandemic, but we're seeing plenty of new construction now in New York. You're going to see a lot more. When you think about the types of industries here, hospitality, for God's sakes, what was hit harder by the pandemic? And we were the epicenter. And yet, 57 million tourists last year, we will surpass our record of 67 million, most likely in the next 2 years. So the problem with the whole argument is it misunderstands our resiliency.
But what if you live upstate? What if you're in Rochester? What if you're in Utica or Syracuse? You're not getting those tourists.
There's unfortunately a lot of truth in that. Not all places, you're getting them in some places. But look, I think upstate has real challenges. I don't want to sugarcoat that. I do think, again, let's put this in national context. All of the big powerhouse industrial cities that pre-World War II were booming, including places like Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, all of them suffered. All of the what quote-unquote Rust Belt suffered. New York State, upstate New York, deserves a lot more support from our state government, from our federal government, to make a transition because they have fantastic universities, fantastic hospitals, some extraordinary corporations that have been there a long time. There's plenty of opportunity that can be created in upstate New York.
Okay, John, I suppose we might hear that argument for another decade because, by the way, those are all sectors that, you know, they've been impacted, but New York City and New York State are lagging the national recovery in all of those areas.
All right, another state policy I'd like to ask you to take on, Rayhan, and bring it into the conversation is just income tax. So New York State has an income tax rate of 10.9% at the state level. New York City adds to that, so it comes up to 14.8 versus a state tax income tax rate in Florida of zero. Is that part of the argument that you're making why Florida is kind of doing it right vis-a-vis New York?
I could make that argument, but I think that I don't even have to because actually when you're looking at every other issue, the kind of edge that Florida has over us is so significant. But I will say that New York state and local revenues and spending per resident were around $20,000 in 2019. They've since ballooned. They've since grown quite a bit. That's more than double Florida's figure of $9,300. Now, if you're looking at service quality, we talked about it before. When you're looking at basics of reading and math for fourth graders, there is just a dramatic, dramatic difference. There are some services in New York that, you know, I'm incredibly proud of. I'm a son of public employees. I'm someone who really does believe that there are a lot of conscientious, hardworking public servants in this city and in this state. Proud of them. But it's also the case that when you look at the jobs recovery, we have not had a private sector jobs recovery. We have had a public sector jobs recovery. And the problem is that if we want to pay people well in the public sector, we need to have a productive economy that's throwing off revenue. I might favor a different tax system, but the truth is that really high taxes aren't what's driving out households from this state. There are a lot of people who would be willing to pay that. The bigger problem are the kind of deeper pathologies of policymaking in New York State. So, I certainly think lower taxes as a general matter are a good thing, but certainly you can make the case that high taxes and high quality services are a great, great mix. The problem is that in New York State right now, what we have are high taxes and quite low quality services for many of the most critical essential services. And that's a big problem.
Rayhan, respectfully, I just don't think you are. Maybe you don't. You haven't experienced it. Maybe you don't see it. Maybe it's ideologically different for you. Okay, so what do we have? I said the best police force in the country, the best fire department in the country. We have the best health apparatus in the entire country between our public hospitals, our health department, our private voluntary hospitals. We are unsurpassed in this country in health care for people of all economic levels. We have a variety of—
Can I just ask you, by what metric? By what's available or by outcomes?
I'm not ever going to tell you, John, I have the perfect outcome statistics. So what I can tell you is what's available. We provide health care for anyone and everyone on a quality level. In fact, in my administration, we made a decision that any New Yorker who could not legally get insurance still could get direct health care on a systematic basis from our public hospitals and clinics, even undocumented immigrants. That is a compassionate, inclusive society that keeps people healthy. Florida doesn't do that.
I want to move into a new phase of the conversation here. I want to introduce a group of journalists who have agreed to come into the conversation and move things forward with questions that come from their experience covering both New York and Florida. And the first one up is Emma Fitzsimmons of the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on in with your question.
Thank you for having me. So Mayor, as you know, I have two young sons. One is hopefully starting 3K for all this year. That program and universal pre-K are a major reasons for families to stay in New York City. So I'm curious, are you concerned that Mayor Adams is making 3K less of a priority? Could that hurt the livability and affordability of New York City? And then what does Florida have to offer for families similarly?
I appreciate your focus on an issue I love dearly. We know, and we've seen it in so many instances, that providing a full-day, high-quality pre-K originally and now almost universal 3K is one of the things that allows people of all income levels to be here, stay here, thrive here. And we know that is the kind of generous, compassionate service that is not the norm in Florida. We also know that our sense of quality that we bring to our public commitments is not always shared by other states. So I think it's very fair to say that New York had such amazing advantages before pre-K and 3K. We are literally added almost two full grades to our public schools in a matter of a few years. That would never happen in Florida because they don't believe in that kind of, certainly the current government, at least of Florida, doesn't believe in that kind of investment. So I think if we're talking about a livable city, an affordable city, there are many factors. Providing for young families in this generous, inclusive way, literally for everyone, is a tremendous factor in favor of New York City. The values part is to make sure that everyone starts at the same starting line. Everyone has opportunity, whether it is that immigrant family that's striving, that's starting with very little, whether it is someone who's in the middle class and trying to stay here, everyone has the same opportunity.
More from Open to Debate when we return.
Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around, a watch she can wear every day from Movement. Whether your mom is into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, everything at Movement is up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale. A watch is a gift that celebrates all the time you spent with mom. And a Movement watch is even more than that. Movement uses industry-leading materials for their fresh, modern watch designs, from technically complex ceramics to vintage-inspired style, all for an incredible value your wrist and wallet will both love. And with one-size-fits-all convenience and fast, free shipping and returns, it's a stress-free shopping experience. Save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with Movement. Get up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.
Welcome back. I'm John Donvan, and this is Open to Debate. Let's jump right back into our discussion.
Beyond that, strategically, it was quite clear this was a way to address the fact that I spoke incessantly about affordability problems, including in my campaign in 2013. And my answer was raise wages, raise benefits, provide more direct services like pre-K, 3K, after school, which we proceeded to do. It lifts an economic burden off of families. It allows so many family members, particularly women, to go back to the workforce. it allows people to take a massive expense off. There was a great tweet I saw last year.
It's got to be really quick.
Someone from Seattle who thought they were going to come to New York and pay more, they said, when I factor in pre-K for my child, my cost of living is actually cheaper in New York than it was in Seattle.
Thank you for being so quick. And Emma, thank you very much for your question. I want to go now to Julia Marsh of Politico. Julia, thanks for joining us.
I'd love to hear from both sides why they think that this conversation usually focuses on the wealthy, and why have we actually not heard a lot about these so-called strivers that are leaving?
Ryan, why don't you go first?
Gosh, I think you might want to ask former Mayor de Blasio about that. Because I think that the political discourse in New York City and New York State for a long time has really been pretty darn fixated on the top 0.01%. I think that is not, to my mind, I think that there are a lot of kind of core challenges about the quality of life, about whether or not working class and middle class New Yorkers are getting a fair shake, why it is that that actually you have seen this incredible domestic out-migration for so long. My own view is that I don't think we should canonize and celebrate millionaires and billionaires necessarily, but I also think that when you have a highly productive place, the power of economic agglomeration is such that you want to be a city that's kind of attractive to a wide range of people, whether they're really poor or really rich. I actually think that that diversity, the fact that you have a range of different lifestyle possibilities, I think that that is a good and healthy mix. The problem is that what New York City is doing right now is creating conditions that are tolerable for the ultra rich, but intolerable for lower income folks. And it could be, Julia, that the reason why we don't actually talk about, working and middle class people is because the city has kind of taken them for granted, has dealt with so much out-migration of those folks for so long, and the tax base hasn't suffered, and people have, been just fine. Now the tax base is under strain. Now that's changing a little bit because you actually have some number of middle income, upper middle income families who are a core part of the city's tax base, who are you do see some out-migration of those groups too. But, my personal view is that the massive out-migration of working and middle-class people is a massive catastrophe. And by the way, it actually makes the city less attractive to, these super-duper entrepreneur types as well.
Julia, thank you for your question. I want to go now to Jeff Conklin, who is a political reporter for City and State New York. Jeff, come on in.
Thank you for giving me some time to ask. Look, when we're talking about people moving to Florida instead of New York or choosing Florida, are we wrong to assume that it has this much to do with politics and values? And isn't it just about, or cost? And is it just about weather? I mean, Florida has always had better weather. It's warmer. But on the flip side, now we see video of Fort Lauderdale underwater. Hurricanes seem to maybe be getting worse. Is New York going to maybe gain back some of that ground?
We hadn't gotten to the weather angle in any depth, so that's a really interesting filter for this. Bill, why don't you talked about how nice the weather is down there, but Jeff is suggesting maybe it's diminishing returns for Florida.
First of all, I thank you, Jeff, for the common sense. Yes, I understand why some people, the number one factor might be weather, and that's human and that's normal. That's been particularly true. Not a news flash. That's been true for hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers who retire, for example. But I do think you have to look at the whole picture of any place. If you happen to have good weather today, will you have the same good weather tomorrow, or will it be more extreme weather? If you happen to have in the past perhaps been a more open social environment, but you become an increasingly closed environment and negative and exclusionary environment, as the MAGA extremism of Florida is doing now, does the world change? I think it does. So each of these things is in evolution, but I agree with you. I mean, some of it is as simple as the larger movement over decades from all of the industrialized North to all of the Sun Belt. That is not something that a set of policies developed, because you can look across the industrialized North at all sorts of different policies, different states, different cities. People made a choice, but that choice may be a bit time limited, because unfortunately there are bigger factors that are happening in our climate that may cause people to have to reconsider that equation fundamentally.
Rohan?
So, John, when you're thinking about climate and being resilient to climate change, a really important thing is thinking about infrastructure costs. how good at we are executing on projects, how good at we are revamping, deploying new projects, and what have you. That is absolutely essential. The climate challenge is absolutely affecting Florida, but I've got to tell you, it's also affecting New York City and many other cities as well. And when we have such an egregious, severe cost problem, the United States is already an extreme outlier when it comes to the cost of infrastructure. I recommend that everyone check out a report from NYU's Marin Institute on this. But New York City is an outlier among outliers. Compared to London, compared to Paris, compared to Tokyo, there's zero comparison. These are places that have collective bargaining rights. These are places that are high-cost places. These are places where they have complex infrastructure needs. They are democratic publics they have to be responsive to. And yet, on issue after issue, New York City's infrastructure costs are eye-wateringly high. This is a well-established fact. So when it comes to actually adapting and changing, what happens is that you have New York City politicians go hat in hand to Washington, D.C. That's basically, hey, our costs are obscenely high, but we can't possibly afford to undertake these generational projects. Please give us the money. The cost overruns keep rolling in, but here's a problem. As New York State shrinks relative to Florida, your political clout diminishes as well. So actually, that problem of not actually being able to deploy infrastructure dollars thoughtfully, effectively, and efficiently becomes a bigger and bigger problem in a world where we all have to become more resilient.
So what we need in this conversation is a voice from Florida, and we have that in Valerie Crowder, who is a political reporter with WFSU in Florida. So thanks for joining the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. My question is directed to you, Rehan. You mentioned that one of the reasons that you believe people are moving from New York to Florida is because of lower housing costs. Specifically, you mentioned the cities of Miami, Orlando, Tampa, Palm Beach County. But Florida is in an affordable housing crisis, and that crisis spans the entire state, but is especially bad in those cities. Just some quick statistics here for
you. I'm very glad you mentioned this, Valerie. Thank you.
Yes, yes. So the Florida Housing Coalition reports more than 1 million low-income Floridians spend more than half of their household income on housing. And an analysis from the University of Florida shows tens of thousands of Miami-Dade County residents who make the area median income or higher spend more than 30% of their household income on housing, which isn't considered affordable according to federal government standards. So given this data, do you still believe that so-called strivers are moving to Florida for more affordable housing? And if so, how do you square that with the state's affordable housing challenges?
Valerie, first of all, I want to promise the audience that I did not bribe Valerie into asking me this question. So actually, Florida just passed a bipartisan legislation called the Live Local Act that basically preempts a series of local land use regulations and takes a number of other steps as well. Some are recommendations coming from the political right, some coming from the political left. But it's amazing how broad the consensus was that the state needed to take some immediate action to address this housing crisis. And by the way, to Valerie's point, part of the issue is that Florida is still a poorer state than New York, right? So it could be that you have lower housing prices, but they could still have a real bite on people's incomes. It's still drastically more affordable than New York, even when you're looking at it in relative terms, relative to local incomes. But what you've seen is actually Florida lawmakers, again, Republicans and Democrats, in a highly polarized political climate, both in the state and the nation, actually passing some pretty major legislation that, a lot of policymakers, a lot of policy thinkers on the left and right think could make a real dent. In New York State, Governor Hochul proposed some extremely modest, measured, incremental reforms. And what she's found is just intense, ferocious pushback from the folks who are supposed to be her allies in the state legislature. So, I'm not saying that Florida is perfect. Far from it. On that issue alone, that's a really life and death issue for the state. They've actually done something. And if you compare that to what's happening in Albany, I think it makes for a really striking contrast.
Let me, if I may, John, just really quickly respond. First of all, I would caution Rehan not to praise a political culture that in just a matter of days was able to pass a 6-week abortion ban in addition to a number of other exclusionary pieces of legislation. So you may think that this example with affordable housing, I'm not familiar with the details of that package, but it's some great example of bipartisanship in Florida. It may be one of the only examples. Unfortunately, the dominant strand in Florida is MAGA extremism. But when it comes to the question of how do you address affordability, it's interesting, this dialogue from Rehan's point of view has often been about the cost of housing, and that's a valid discussion. I want to bring it back to one raising wages and benefits, which New York keeps doing, city and state, and two, providing other support for people. But what I'm trying to say is the state of New York, if you say, oh, they didn't do something, yeah, sure they did something. First of all, they strengthened rent protections for the 2.2 million people in those rent-stabilized apartments in New York City. 2.2 million people, can't say that number enough times. A huge number of people benefited. But second, they raised the minimum wage to $15 a few years ago. And you know, the states that have made the decision that it's important to give people a living wage, it's important to protect labor unions that protect workers' rights and wages and benefits. There's a whole host of things that we do in New York that are about ensuring that working people are respected.
Thank you, Valerie, for your question. We're going to move on to our closing round now. And our closing round, similar to our opening round, each of you makes a statement, but this is a closing statement, and it will be briefer, 1 to 2 minutes. And Bill, since Raihan went first in our opening statements, you have the floor now to tell us one more time why you say Florida is not eating New York's lunch.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you for a fine job moderating this discussion. Okay, what's the reality? The reality is Florida has made a choice. Florida has made a choice to exclude. Florida has made a choice that's not only bad for so many people, for women, for people from the LGBT community, for people who believe in freedom of expression and education that includes all different perspectives. It's bad for business. Just ask the folks at the Disney Corporation. How fascinating that the government of Florida has attacked one of their biggest employers. Well, there's going to be ramifications for that when other employers say this is not a place for us. But that's not even the thing I want to focus on. I want to focus on a force more powerful than the state of Florida, more powerful than anything even in New York City, and that's Mother Nature. Jeff Colton asked the question, and I want to take the next step with that question. Unfortunately, and I feel bad for all of us, climate change is moving aggressively. It's going to hurt us all, but it's going to hurt Florida a lot more. And I don't say that with any joy. I say that with pain for our fellow Americans who are there. But the truth is, this is going to be more and more of a drain on Florida, more and more of a challenge. In fact, a recent study looked at the regions of the world that were most threatened by climate change based on recent UN data. And this study said that 9 of the top 10 were parts of coastal China. The 10th was Florida. In all the United States, by far the place that will suffer the most damage from climate change. We see the horrible destruction of the hurricanes. We see the flooding. This is just the beginning. When you ask the question, and it's colloquial, who's eating whose lunch, it really comes down to where do people want to be? Where do they have faith in the future? Well, the future, unfortunately, is not bright for Florida. And in fact, I hope and I pray the government of Florida will do so much more to address climate change. New York State has been a leader in that field and needs to do more, but it has been a leader. But right now, the truth is, threats to Florida, the human-made threats coming out of their state government are bad enough and will hinder the Florida's economic and social future. But the threat from Mother Nature is so much greater. We are a nation. We are a part of our nation. We are a state and a city. We have problems, but we have been wonderfully insulated from most of the challenges of the climate crisis. Thank God we have an ample water supply. We have incredibly inherent strengths, lots of mass transit, the things that will make us strong even in a changing future. So the future is with New York City. And I just finished by saying it's so interesting how people love to bet against New York City. They always lose. They always lose.
Thank you, Bill. Now, Raihan, you have the final say here. It's your rebuttal, but there's just a question that's kind of hanging out there. You appear to be committed to staying in New York. I just would like you to address that, and I can give you an extra 30, 40 seconds to address that. I don't think it's impossible to do whatsoever, but and you're a native New Yorker, but go for it. Here's your closing statement, please.
It's pretty straightforward. My parents moved from Bangladesh to Brooklyn in the mid-70s. When I was growing up, they worked 4 jobs between them and eventually saved enough money to buy a little house, and it's helped them stay as older people in the city we love. If they did not own that house, it's not at all clear to me that they could have done that. And if a similar family moved to Brooklyn right now, they would struggle to afford the rent in a safe neighborhood, let alone save enough money to buy a house and build a little wealth and get a little bit further ahead and help their kids do the same thing. That's not because they'd work any less hard. I promise you that's not true. I know a lot of these people. It's because New York is pulling up the ladder of opportunity. And the truth is that family would be better off moving to Florida. So if you want to know why I'm still here, it's because I love New York. I love living in a big, dense city. But what I see is that the city of opportunity, the city where people were rubbing shoulders, whether you're working class, you're on the subway together, that's a city that I believe in and love. And that city is being drained away by policies that are pulling up the ladder of opportunity. Just one thing that's really striking about this, rents in the five boroughs are going up at the same time that population in four of those boroughs is going down. And the reason is actually quite perverse. Families that can afford it are taking on bigger apartments so that they can have a room, they can have a Zoom room, okay? That's what's happening. Landlords are taking apartments off the market, not because they're twirling their mustaches and they're evil people. It's because they've decided that new regulations that some are praising are actually making it unaffordable and risky to actually rent them out. Huge number of people in this country are landlords and in the city. It's about 7% of folks who file taxes. Those are not all greedy corporate this or that. A lot of them are people who see this as a way to build a little wealth, get a little bit further ahead, and they're scared to do that. And nobody is building the housing we depend on. So basically, the city is gentrifying, and that's okay for me because my parents were kind of working class, you know, kind of folks who fought their way into the middle class, and I kind of have a toehold here, okay? But if you look at the most vulnerable people, people who are homeless, they're not space aliens, they're not criminals, they're not all addicts. These are people who need a place to live. And this is a state where homelessness has gone up by 45% and Florida's gone down by 50%. You can criticize Florida in all sorts of ways, but Florida's stealing our thunder. We should fight to reestablish New York as the opportunity state, but the first step is admitting that we have a problem. I don't have a problem. The former mayor doesn't have a problem. John, you don't have a problem. You have a beautiful room back there. But there are a lot of other people who want to be here and they can't. And I'm going to stay here until they turn the lights out to make sure that we become the opportunity state again.
Thank you, Raihan. And that concludes our debate. The arguing portion of the program is over. I want to thank the journalists who joined us, Emma and Julia and Jeff and Josh, for your questions. I also really want to thank the two of our debaters, Raihan and Bill, for the way that you conducted this debate. You did it with respect, with robust disagreement, but with great civility and good humor, and you shed some light. So I think that that's what our audience is looking for when they come to Open to Debate. They come with an open mind, and at least the two of you were listening to each other, even if not agreeing, so you were open to debate. So I want to thank you both for how you did this and for doing it with us in the first place.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, John.
And I want to thank all of you for tuning into this episode of Open to Debate. You know, as a nonprofit, our work to combat extreme polarization through civil and respectful debate is generously funded by listeners like you, by the Rosencrantz Foundation, and by supporters of Open to Debate. Open to Debate is also made possible by a generous grant from the Laura and Gary Lauder Venture Philanthropy Fund. Robert Rosencrantz is our chairman. Clay O'Connor is CEO. Leah Matthau is our chief content officer. Julia Melfi is our senior producer. Marlette Sandoval is our producer. Gabriella Mayer is our editorial and research manager. Gabrielle Iannicelli is our social media and digital platforms coordinator. Andrew Lipson is head of production. Max Fulton is our production coordinator. Damon Whittemore is our engineer. Raven Baker is events and operations manager. And I'm your host, John Donvan. We'll see you next time.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.